Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss brewing beer with specialty ingredients. This is Beersmith Podcast number 202.
This is the Beersmith Home Brewing Show, where brewing great beer is our passion. If you want to take your brewing to the next level, visit Beersmith.com, where you can download a trial version of our Beersmith software, subscribe to the newsletter, and get dozens of free articles on home brewing. And now, your host and the author of Home Brewing with Beersmith, Brad Smith.
This is Beersmith Podcast number 202, and it's late October 2019. Randy Mosher joins me this week to discuss brewing beer with specialty ingredients. Thank you to this week's sponsors, Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Every issue of Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine is packed with articles for homebrewers and beer lovers. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy. Brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup includes batch sparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the wort clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Plus, it's fast and conveniently sized to help you save space and gain speed without compromising quality. Add the optional new Brew Commander for precise temperature control and mash automation. With the BrewEasy, you'll discover definitive proof that size isn't everything. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I recently converted the BeersmithRecipes.com website to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing and unit conversion tools on the site. So all those independent tools are now available online. Subscribers to Beersmith 3 can access over 17 brewing tools online from any device. And anyone with an account can access thousands of recipes through the Beersmith Recipes site. Visit BeersmithRecipes.com from your phone or computer to learn more. And now let's jump into this week's episode. Today on the show, I welcome back Randy Mosher. Randy is the author of Mastering Homebrew, Radical Brewing, and Tasting Beer. He's also a partner in two breweries near Chicago, Five Rabbit and Forbidden Root. Randy, it's great to have you back on the show.
Always great to be here, Brad.
So how have you been? What have you been up to the last, it's been over a year now since I had you on the show, believe it or not.
I know. I was looking at it. It's been since November. I had a lot of travel, went to Spain to do some homebrew stuff, and then did 10 days in three cities in Brazil for Mundial de la Bière, and we did a bunch of collaborations and poured those at the festival, and then I did some training in São Paulo and Rio and Porto Alegre. Just a blast. A lot of work, but people are really cool down there, and the beers are really creative and they're getting really good. So it was pretty exciting to see that.
Yeah, I was down there a number of years ago, and the craft beer industry was really just starting then, but I would imagine it's progressed quite a bit since then, right?
It has. I mean, it's still small. They struggle against a really unfair taxation system and lack of distribution, and pricing. A craft beer is about 10 times the price of a not craft beer. So it's pretty extreme, but they're doing it. You know, it's amazing.
And then they have tariffs too. So it's hard to get ingredients and stuff there too, I think. Right.
Exactly. That's why their beers are so expensive, because the government taxes the ingredients. It's like 50% or 100% on ingredients and equipment. And then that makes everything expensive. So then that gets multiplied by this crazy tax system that they have. So it's just nuts.
Well, I don't want to go into taxes. We did that last time with Blickman, or a couple episodes ago with Blickman. So anyways, today I wanted to talk about brewing specialty beers, including special ingredients. And what do you, the author of Radical Brewing, mean by specialty beer?
Well, I guess you'd say just really anything outside that old Rheinheitsgebot. You know, yeah. Beers using herbs, fruits, spices. I mean, you know, basically beer is an herb product anyway. Hops are an herb, but it's a you know, it's just the one herb that has become dominant in brewing. But before, you go back 1,000 years or more, and there were quite a bit of other hop or other herbal products that were used in beer in medieval times and in the ancient world. So hops are kind of new at a 17,000 years of beer history. Hops are kind of like the last 1,000 years or so, more or less.
Is that right? They go back 1,000 years? I thought it was less than that, actually. But
yeah, they've got chemical evidence for hops going back to, I think it's about 500 BC in northern Italy. But around 900 AD, that was about the beginning of hops starting to spread, starting in northern Germany and eventually to Amsterdam and Flanders and England.
And of course, you don't limit yourself to spices and herbs either, right?
Spices, herbs, roots, berries, barks, twigs, you know, old skateboards, whatever.
Just about anything you make beer from, huh?
Well, you know, it's really sort of what can you find an intriguing ingredient to build a beer around it? Then you take a food or another beverage and try and recreate that flavor in with the ingredients that you have available to you when you brew beer. So there's a lot of different ways to come at it, but you know, it's a challenge either way, and you really need to be thoughtful about both the specialty ingredients and all the rest of the stuff that you're putting in the beer to help make it sing.
Well, that brings me right into my next question. What are some of the basic principles around designing a specialty beer?
Well, again, it sort of depends whether you're trying to start with an idea. Like we made a beer at Forbidden Root that was a Negroni beer. So that's a cocktail that has gin and Campari. I forget what else is in there. I think a little bit of bitters, but pretty simple drink, but the Campari is very complicated and there's a lot of interesting herbal ingredients in there. Things like rhubarb root and quite a bit of orangey flavor. So we started looking at recipes, sort of DIY liqueur recipes, and pulled some of those out. I think there's some gentian in there. I think that's the bittering compound. So we were trying to, just work with that one. And so we were just really looking at what we could bring from the hops. So we could bring the bitterness from the hops. We could bring some of the citrus notes from the hops and start there. And one of the key principles is, like, you want your brewing ingredients, your traditional ingredients, to do as much of the heavy lifting as you can get them to do. And then you don't have to rely so heavily on the special ingredients. And then it makes that connection to beer where you're really trying to, you're not really making a Negroni. You're making a beer that reminds people of a Negroni. So if you can substitute mostly hops for most of that gentian, you've got a quality bitterness that is more appropriate in the beer sphere, because some of those bitter herbs are a little different. They're perceived a little differently than the bitterness that comes from hops. And then if you're trying to do a beer around a special ingredient, you got to think, well, okay, let's use cherries. But first of all, you got to look at, well, what kind of cherries do we want to use? You know, there are three or four types of cherries you can get in the United States pretty easily. You got a sweet one, you can get a sour Montmorency, those real bright red cherry pie cherries. You can get sometimes some Balatons, some more or less a European type. You can actually get access to a Morello, a European cherry that has what we Americans think of as a cough syrup flavor. And so you can pick one and go with that. If you're doing a Montmorency cherry, that's the pie cherry. Do you want to make a beer taste like pie? You know, do you want to use a little psychological sort of memory trick for the people who are drinking it and put in some biscuit malt or something like that that might remind people a little bit of a pie crust, for example? And it's really about trying to picture your end product and what you're trying to do and then figure out how to get there.
I remember a couple of years back, you gave me a beer that was made, I think, from roasted bananas, right? Something like that.
Yeah, it was a collaboration we did with at Five Rabbit with Cigar City. and it was caramelized ripe plantain bananas, maduros, they call them. And I was like two people, three 14-hour days or some crazy thing like that, just caramelizing these bananas on a stovetop. It was sort of nuts.
But, you actually did it on a stovetop?
We did, yeah.
For a commercial-sized batch?
Yeah, well, yeah, it was a 60-barrel batch. So that was, wow. I think it was about 1,200 pounds of bananas, if I recall correctly, of plantanos.
Well, often when we're working with a specialty beer, we're looking for those layers of flavor, you know, sure. Not just a single dimension. How do you actually go about creating different layers of flavor in a specialty beer?
Well, what we always try and do is create one whole impression, and then as you drink the beer, you know, your palate kind of shifts around, your attention can change a little bit, and once you have become acclimated to the overall taste of the beer, then your brain sort of shuts that off and it starts looking for, well, what have I not noticed in here? And so if you can, you know, by carefully controlling the amount of different flavors in there so that you put them together so that they work together to create a harmonious whole, and then at the same time, you usually can get them to sort of be in that beer in a way that, you know, maybe on the back palate, or maybe in the nose, or some other way. You know, you have so many different ways you can pay attention to the sensor, you know, to the sensory qualities of that beer. So that gives you a lot of different opportunities to get that sort of layering. And we find that doing it that way, again, creating that hole and then having those layers come up is just because you get that initial impact and people react to that, but then at the same time, you don't really want them to get bored with the beer. You want them to enjoy it, get to the bottom of that first glass and think, yeah, I believe I'll have another one of those. There was still stuff coming out in that, you know, I'm still interested.
So Randy, I know you wrote the book on sensory perception, and we talked quite a bit in the past on some of the podcasts about sensory things. How do you use the psychology of beer to create these experiences or flavors in people's minds?
Well, our chemical senses are very emotional, and compared to vision, where we things that we see get interpreted and processed and recoded and decoded and turned into a three-dimensional manifestation of the reality that surrounds us, and it does that very well. Smell goes directly through up to your emotional memory centers of your brain within just a couple of synapses. So it just loads all that data and just dumps it right into your emotional centers. And so what that means is that over our lifetimes, we accumulate an inventory of things that we like and we don't like, because that's what olfaction and taste are really all about. They're designed to move you towards food or a potential mate, and they are really evolutionarily created to move you away from danger. And so we don't, up until relatively recently, we haven't had a need to really describe things or categorize them. It's just like good or bad. And so we're fortunate in the world of beer that we're part of the world of food, and the flavors that we find in beer, people already have memory associations with them. So if you think about the vocabulary of malt, for example, we have bread, crackers, cookies, cake, caramel, toffee, roasty, toasty, chocolate, coffee, espresso, right? So those are things that most people feel pretty good about. And so as a brewer, you know, this is one of our tools to create some feeling for our beers. And hops, of course, remind us of fruits. They remind us of citrus. They remind us of flowers, lots of other things we like. You know, bitterness is a bit of an acquired thing, but we're in a group of people that have acquired that already, so it's not generally a problem. And the same goes, you know, if we were thinking about that cherry pie beer, you know, that's a thing for people in the United States that will instantly transport them back to their childhood or some dinner. You know, cherry pie is just super iconic, and people generally have a pretty nice warm feeling about them. And so that's the kind of psychology I mean. But you have to think about how do you create an image of something that's not really there? It's not really pie. right? So it's not, you're not really going to get a complete image, but you have to understand that each flavor that you use has certain components to it, and your brain wants to help out. Your brain is trying to find ways to match what it sees with the pattern that it already knows. So it doesn't have to be a complete 100% real, but you can use a few important cues is the word. Yeah, a few really important cues, and actually they've done a lot of research onto things like fruits and chocolates, and you know, chocolate's composed of I think 6 or 7 different flavor components, and one of them's roasty, one of them's fruity, one of them's a bit like a wine-like thing, one of them's a little bit, I think it's a little bit herbal, resinous, vanilla maybe. One of them is actually like it's like a greasy potato chippy kind of aroma. And if you take any one of those legs out, if you take those 7, you could take 7 chemicals and you could put them together and people taste it and think, oh, that's pretty chocolatey. Now, it may not be like fine Belgian Couverture chocolate, but your brain will create that illusion. But if you take one leg, one of those cues away, then the whole thing starts to fall apart. And so that's what we like to really get in and understand our ingredients really well and figure out what makes them tick. And then, you know, again, if you're thinking about a cherry, you can get the cherries, you can put the cherries in, so you're pretty good on that. But if you think about, again, part of this illusion is if you're eating pie or you're just putting a cherry, you know, eating a cherry straight out of hand, that has a certain expectation as on the part of the person eating it or drinking your beer, actually, where there's a certain expectation of fruit aroma, which we can deliver that pretty well. But there's also a certain mouthfeel. There's also a certain sweet aspect. There's also a certain level of acidity. And now we're trying to take and do that in a beer, but maybe now we've only got about 10% fruit. So we have 10% of the acidity and 10% of the mouthfeel and 10% of the sweetness. And so you have to find ways to go back in and put those other legs on, you know, and give people enough acidity. That's a super, super important one with fruits, because if you don't have enough acidity, the fruit really tastes flat and dull. In the wine business, they call that flabby. And so it's easy enough to do either with a sour mashing technique or you don't have to go that far. You can add some lactic acid. You can add some citric acid, phosphoric. And actually, you can even pick an acid that is the acid that's in the fruit. So you can look up online, see what kind of acidity, how much citric acid, how much malic acid, what other kinds of acids are in a cherry, because each one of those acids has a somewhat different taste presentation in your mouth. Some are sharp, some are real clean, some are real sharp, some are real like malic is almost a little tannic. You think about the sourness of an apple.
Yeah, definitely.
Almost tannic. So it has a little bit of a raspy edge to it, whereas lactic is real super creamy. So if you're trying to do a cherry ice cream beer, you know, lactic is real good because that lactic acidity is a cue for dairy, right? And if you get a little bit of a buttery kind of flavor in there, which you often do with fruit, actually, that can kind of really give you that illusion. And then, of course, I always think if you take any kind of flavor and you throw some vanilla in it, it automatically ice creamifies it, right? Because vanilla is such a strong cue for ice cream, because it's virtually in every single ice cream that's made out there.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's talk ingredients. Can you talk a little about first the importance of understanding the basic beer ingredient flavors, you know, the basic malts and hops that we're working with?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I've been doing some training, some workshops on recipe formulation and brand positioning and things like that. And one of the exercises we do is we go through and actually make some malt teas and taste different kinds of malts. Because I think, you know, we're habitual creatures, generally speaking. And I think that we all get in our ruts. We have our go-to dark malts, maybe 2 or 3 dark malts we use. We, you know, just have habitually either used, you know, Carafa or some English black malt or whatever. And we kind of tend to reach for those consistently without necessarily understanding the differences. I think maybe part of that is it's we tend to use our eyes to evaluate things a little more than we should. And so each one of those different dark colored malts, from chocolate to, but even within different manufacturers making the same color malt, they can be quite different in flavor. So one exercise we did at Forbidden Root is we got about 20 different kinds of dark malts, and we made malt teas out of them. Mm-hmm. And took those malt teas and then made basically like 100 grams of malt, 250 grams of water, hot water, let it stand 10, 15 minutes and run it through a coffee filter. And then you can kind of let it settle out because you get some fine dust out of there. And then you can blend that back into some kind of basic lager or...
And that, I think there's a standard ASBC method for doing that now too, isn't there? Something like that?
I don't have to really be the standard, but it's super simple. It's really easy to do. It doesn't take any special... But you'd be surprised. I mean, we were shocked at some black malts tasted like just beautiful stout, just really clean, simple. Some of them tasted chocolatey, and there were ones that tasted kind of like cheap chocolate. There were ones that tasted kind of like fine dark chocolate. Same with coffee. There were some that tasted like old stale diner coffee and some that tasted like really fine espresso. And so we were careful to take notes, knowing that we were working on coffee beers and we're working on chocolate beers. And so we want to be able to pick these malts to use the kind of to use the ones with the flavor that got us closest to our finished beer as we could before we started to put the special ingredients in.
Well, that brings us to specialty ingredients. Can you talk a little bit about how to work with some of the specialty ingredients? Perhaps start with herbs and spices.
Sure. There's some contexts that are pretty familiar to everybody using orange peel and coriander in wit beer, for example. This has been a thing that is a wit beer has been a kind of a special hobby of mine for a very long time. And one of the things that I like about wit beer is that there are so many different ways to screw it up. And one of the ways that people tend to make mistakes with it is just assuming that coriander is coriander. Now, I got a big set of spice books downstairs. It's like 3 volumes. It's like, I don't know, 1,500 pages or something. It's insane. But there are 30 pages in the book about coriander, right? Wow. So what that means is that like every ingredient that's out there on the planet, whether it's black pepper or coriander or grains of paradise, or certainly when you get into fruits and things, it's just as complicated in terms of the differences in varieties and the way it's grown, the way it's harvested, where it comes from, as our hops, right? And we really understand that with hops, and we really pay a lot of attention to the terroir aspect of it, and certainly hops that are grown in the United States that are European varieties, they come out different, and I think everybody has a reasonable understanding of that. But yet people just go to the grocery store and they grab any old coriander and they grind it up and throw it in without really thinking about it. And one of the things we like really dig into the chemistry of stuff. And so we had a batch of beer at one of my breweries, and I got that batch of beer and I just smelled something I didn't like in it. And it's like, let me see that coriander. And it, to me, it was it's a coriander that tends to present itself with a little bit more of a cilantro, or kind of, it always comes across to me as a bit celery-like aspect.
Okay.
So I started like, what is the deal with that chemical? Why is some coriander have that and some doesn't? And it turns out that coriander goes through a ripening process. You know, it has those little ribs on it on the outside. If you look at it closely, mm-hmm. Those are hollow and they're full of oil. That's where the oil is. But it turns out that coriander actually has an equal set of little tubules on the inside. And when the grain is unripe, the tubes on the inside are full of a type of a chemical called a saturated aldehyde. And aldehydes can be anywhere from grassy to kind of fatty things. And that saturated aldehyde is that cilantro thing that people have a genetic susceptibility to. Like, you know, there are people, right, who for coriander leaf, just they find it repellent and really soapy and just like absolutely can't put it in their mouth. And for me, I like it but I like it in food, but I don't really like that flavor in beer. And so, you know, just one little detail about how, and as the grain ripens, it kind of switches over from the saturated aldehydic, soapy celery seed kind of flavor to that more beautiful piney, resiny, sometimes lemony, orange, or kind of really more orangey sort of character that you get in a really nice piece of coriander. And, you know, so that's just one ingredient that really is, you know, the, being selective about your ingredient and really understanding the chemistry of it and how it happens and what to be looking for, what how to select it, can make an enormous difference in the quality of the beer.
So what are some general methods for working with herbs and spices?
Well, the easiest way to do it, what I would say is if you can throw it, if you can use it in the whirlpool or really in home brewing, it would be right when you turn the heat off at the end of the boil. That's the best way to, that's the best way to use most kind of herbs and spices. You want some coriander in your beer. You just, you know, grind it coarsely and throw it in right at the end of the, right at the end of the boil. And otherwise, as Pierre Celis once told us, yes, otherwise it is just for the neighbors, huh? You know, meaning that if you put it in earlier in the boil, you're just going to boil away all that wonderfulness. Now, with really expensive things like saffron, coffee, chocolate, really more expensive ingredients, and certainly fruit, you really don't want to add them there. It's much better to add them later in the process, post-fermentation or towards the end of fermentation in the case of fruits, because just like boiling, fermentation creates a large amount of gas coming out of the beer. And so all that gas is going to pull out a lot of aromas. And so you're going to be losing aroma.
Right.
And there's even a technique called Gespunding that the breweries use quite often. It's basically natural carbonation. So they'll take the beer to a certain, once fermentation is nearly done, they'll cap the fermenter and allow the pressure to build up naturally. And if you put your specialty ingredients, like if you're making that cherry pie beer, if you put your cherries in maybe day three, day four, when the yeast is still going, but most of the sugars in the beer, in the wort have been used up, then that will continue to finish out. But if you have the fermenter still venting off, you're going to blow off a lot of fruity aromas. And if you cap that fermenter, you're going to get a lot more aroma. And so they've done studies on it. We've tried it with beers that we've done, and we find that we definitely get enhanced fruit aroma. And, you know, that stuff's expensive in a commercial setting. Fruits really often cost just as much as the whole rest of the recipe combined. So we need to find ways to get the most out of it.
So you prefer fruits in the secondary then?
Fruits in the, yeah, we wouldn't call it secondary, but it would just say fruits towards the end of fermentation, when you're mostly attenuated, but you still have some yeast activity. Again, for us, it's maybe day three in a commercial setting, right. maybe a little longer in a home brewery, depending. But you can see that croissant start to fall, where you're no longer building up foam on top of the beer in the carboy, and it starts to slow down. And then you can throw it in at that point. You know, you don't want to really package with fruit, unfermented fruit in any kind of package, because it's you know, that does have some sugars. Some of them seem to be a little sluggish to ferment sometimes also. So you don't really want to have beer still fermenting in your package.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people don't realize the amount of sugar in the fruit, and a lot of that goes away. So you end up, you know, a lot of the sweetness disappears when you're working with fruit, right?
Yeah, the sweetness definitely disappears. So, you know, you can, again, mouthfeel is a good cue for sweetness. Tiny amounts of vanilla are good, can be a cue for sweetness. There's actually some products that are sold commercially that are a type of licorice extract, and even licorice itself is a chemical that that plays with your sweet taste buds and kind of enhances the perception of sweetness, even though it is not really particularly sweet itself. So again, and it doesn't have to be a huge amount of sweetness. But a little bit is usually a good thing. Also, caramelly notes. You know, if you're making that cherry beer and you use a little bit of caramel malt, or not, maybe a little light caramel, like caramel 10, caramel 20, or I would prefer maybe a Vienna malt. And that Vienna malt has a really nice carameliness. And although caramel, as it ferments out, is not really sweet, but it's an aroma that we perceive as sweet because caramel in our mouths is almost always accompanied by sugar, right? So again, it's that psychology where our brain puts stuff together and combine, like, oh, caramel, that must be sweet. Vanilla, that's got to be sweet because that's in the way we use vanilla, that's only used for sweet stuff, right? Mm-hmm. That's important to understand that.
And what about working with different forms of fruit? I mean, whole fruit's great, but it can be difficult to work with at times. And then you have purees and a whole bunch of other different options.
Yeah, I mean, if you've got a huge garden and you got fresh strawberries and stuff, go for it. But I think that, you know, the problem with fruit, again, is it's expensive. If you have chunks of fruit, it tends to want to float on top of your beer. I've had several times when there's fruit floating in the carboy. And then that there's because now you've got a food source and oxygen that's exposed in that top of the carboy after fermentation, then the mold can start growing on there.
Yeah, I know most winemakers punch it down at least a couple times a day, I think is what you have to do, right?
It's about doing that or else the mold will start to take hold because mold can't really live inside the liquid, but it can sure live on top of it. So that's an important thing. You want to chop it up as fine as you can. If you can trust a Cuisinart to be reasonably sterile, which seems like a tall order, but a stick blender, maybe a really well cleaned stick blender might do it for you. That's good. But most fruits are available in puree form. If you go to the freezer compartment of your grocery store or an ethnic market, like a Chinese market or especially a Latin market, you know, you get pineapple, mango, guava, and a bunch of other stuff you may have never heard about that's really cool. And those are usually in like 14-ounce packets. One or two of those will do nicely for a batch of beer. And you just thaw them out and dump them in. Those are aseptic, some sort of a sanitized puree type of thing. So those are great. You can also, if you're looking for more conventional fruits like blueberries, things like that, go to the homebrew shop and buy wine kits or wine concentrates and stuff. So those are really pretty good. So the purees tend to be closest to the whole fruit. We make a strawberry beer at Forbidden Root. It's a strawberry basil Hefeweizen. So we put strawberry puree, just a single strength puree. Also use a little bit of a stronger concentrated puree. It gives us a bit of a jammy note that we think adds an extra dimension. We don't want too much jam. It's not a jam beer. It's a fresh fruit tasting beer, but a little bit of the jam adds a kind of a flavor, extra flavor note. So that's another example of how you're adding depth and layers by just adding two slightly different things instead of just one. And then we come back in with what we call a top note product or a natural extract. So these are available. You can also get them at the homebrew shops. They're little bottles of a liquid clear material that has been distilled off of a natural product. And so they are like really purely concentrated aromatics. Now, those alone don't make a great fruit beer. But we do find plenty of use for them to kind of replace things that often don't really make it through the fermentation process really well. And we find that just coming back in with a few drops or, you know, for a homebrew, you might be talking about 20 mils, 50 mils, something like that, 100 mils max of these extracts to really bring back a little bit of that aroma that seems to lose and change during fermentation.
Now, do you have trouble separating like the puree? I know in the past when I've made mead with puree, I end up with a lot of waste.
Yeah, unfortunately, everything that people like in beer, hops, coffee, chocolate, fruit, creates a lot of sludge in the bottom of the tanks. And unless you have specialized centrifuges and things like that to really be able to squeeze the liquid out of that sludgy stuff, you're just going to get a lot of loss. I find, you know, with homebrew, you can let it settle out. If you could rack off most of a batch, and if you can then rack off the sludgy part and put it in a gallon jug and throw it in the refrigerator for a few days, you may be able to recover maybe 2/3 of that extra gallon. Just give it a little extra time to settle.
Yeah, I've also had some success bagging the fruit, you know, like in a grain bag kind of thing.
Yeah, you can do that. That'll keep some of the chunks out. If you got really chunky stuff,
it lets me control the contact time too. Like a lot of times you don't want the fruit sitting on there for weeks and weeks and weeks, you know?
Yeah, but generally, you know, what I found is you leave that fruit in there for a week or two till you really have fermentation quite stopped. And then you can rack it off into a second carboy if you need to.
A week's about right.
Kind of clear out, yeah. In fact, too long, you can really start to extract things that you don't want. You start to pull some phenolic compounds and take a little more tannic stuff than you may want.
Well,
As long as we're talking about fruit, I should just mention one of the other really important psychological cue is color. Mm-hmm. Right? So we totally drink with our eyes. If you give people a strawberry beer that's colored yellow, they'll have no idea what it is. You know, so having that reinforcement of the color is super important. They've done numerous scientific studies with professional wine judges, and what they find that if they give them white wine that's been tinted with red wine, guess what happens? You know, they're getting bramble and blackberry and, you know, all this red fruit out of there, even though it's white grape juice. It's just really, really powerful. So don't forget that. Hibiscus is a nice way to get some color. That's easy. The color tends to fade a bit after a while, but you can like overdo it a little bit at the beginning, knowing that it's going to fade out when you're serving it over some weeks. There are some coloring materials made from things like carrots. You can use a little bit of black currant juice of what do they call it? Aronia berry has a real nice color. If you're not super sensitive to that musty compounds that are in beets, beet color is gorgeous.
Well, there's several other topics we want to cover, but I wanted to get to, since I think it's so important, I want to get the idea of prototyping and scaling, because I think it becomes really important when working with a lot of these unusual flavors. So can you dive into that for a minute?
Yeah, totally. Making beer batch after batch after batch, just to trying to figure out what you're doing and how to make it is really cumbersome. And if you can save yourself a lot of time by working on a small scale first. And the way we normally do it at our breweries is we will decide what the recipe is, really have a good picture, not necessarily the recipe, but what we're trying to accomplish, like what we want that beer to be like in the glass, what's the color, what's the bitterness, what's the gravity, what's the malt character. And so we'll go out and we'll find commercial beers, whether they're our own or somebody else's, that have certain characteristics that we want to be able to blend together to create our final beer. And so, you can take an imperial porter, but if you want a little less roasty character, you can blend it down with a triple, and you still have a strong beer, and it's still dark, but it doesn't have quite as much roastiness. Or you can get a beer that has a certain type of caramel malt aroma. You can take a beer that has a certain hop profile, a certain bitterness, a certain aromatic profile, and you start mixing them together. Get a blending sheet together that you can keep track of how much of what you're putting in.
That becomes a base for your prototype, right?
Then yeah, so we'll normally do 100 mils or 200 mils, something like that. And we've got little graduated cylinders or syringes and things, and we'll blend it all up or just use the markings that are on the beaker. And then keep track of it. And then so then you can go back in and you can say, okay, that IPA, let's go on Rate Beer or go to the brewery site and think, what's the bitterness of it? What kind of hops do they say they use? And then now you have a data point for a third of your beer, and then you can find whatever that next beer is and the next beer. And so based on how that beer tastes to you, or sometimes breweries, you know, are pretty willing to share some aspects of their recipes, even on their website, or certainly if you know somebody there, people will tell you things. And then you can go back and just do some simple sort of story problem math. And now you've got a base beer that you're ready to go. And rather than having spent 3 weeks piloting that and putting it in packaging, you basically are good to go right then, right there. And so once you have your base beer, then you could start laying in your specialty ingredients. So again, if we're making that cherry pie beer, you know, the question is it a light beer, dark beer, amber beer? My guess would be sort of amberish. So I would be looking for a beer that has a little bit of a caramel malt cut flavor. I might be looking a little bit of amber ale mixed maybe with a not too hoppy Pilsner, maybe a Helles. So you're blending down that caramel color with something that's a little paler. Maybe you want a little bit of a slightly like a burnt, like a little toasty on the bottom. You might find a German Dunkel or an Oktoberfest where you can get a little caramel, like a little cookie type of flavor, like burnt cookie kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And so then now you've got a base that you're ready to go. And then you can get some cherry puree or cherry jam or cherry juice concentrate and start putting that in. And again, with a syringe or a pipetter, and you can really, so now you've got your base beer all blended up, you're putting cherry in it. Now you got to think, well, what else would complete that illusion of the pie? And generally, you know, with desserts, a little bit of vanilla is not a bad thing. So you get the bottle of vanilla extract out. The other thing you might think about with cherries is almond extract. So almond extract is very similar to cherry pit kind of flavor. And so almond and cherry are real harmonious flavors together. And at a very small amount of almond, even an amount of almond that's too small to taste by itself, actually can make the cherries taste more cherry-like, or can make an American cherry taste a little bit more like a European cherry. And of course, Montmorency cherries have there's a bit of a cinnamon quality. And so if you want to bring out that sort of cinnamon note, you might want to look at a little bit of cinnamon or cassia. You know, there's cinnamon, there's cassia, there's carinci, there's cassia buds. Each one of those things has a somewhat different set of flavor characteristics that are not exactly the same. And then finally, a little vanilla. And, you know, you can do the vanilla and the almond extract with a pipetter or a little syringe, like a little 1 mil syringe or something like that, and just like drop it in. And then if you don't like that mix, just dump it out, create it over, do another one. And you can really get a lot of work done. And then you've got all your notes. You just go back and think, hey, little of this, little of that, little of the other thing. And same with the flavoring materials.
And then you're going to, of course, scale this up when you produce it, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And we do with things that you can't buy extracts of, bay leaf or grains of paradise or coriander. You make what I call a calibrated tincture. So mm-hmm. you'll take one part of the specialty ingredient and maybe five to 10 parts of vodka, just regular old 80 proof vodka. And grind that stuff up and mix it with vodka, let it stand overnight, give it a stir or two occasionally, and let it kind of settle. And you can run it out through filter paper or a coffee filter. And now you've got a clear liquid, so that for every mil of that liquid you add to your beer, you know exactly how many milligrams of coriander you put in there, right? So if you're making 100 mils and you're basically doing more or less a 19 or 20 liter 5 gallon batch, you know, it's really simple math to figure out, well, how much does that actually, in terms of coriander, how much is that? And then, of course, because you're home brewing, you don't have the prohibition like we do in commercial brewing of we're not really supposed to mix that out, make those alcohol tinctures and add them. You know, a lot of people do. It's super convenient to do. But TTB requires you to get that pre-approved in the formula process to be able to do that. But as home brewers, you know, you can just mix all that up and dump it in and you're good to go. And you could even, say, bottle up half the batch with one strength of this component. And then the next half of the batch, maybe it's the half you're going to save a little longer.
I'm thinking an amaretto liqueur or something like that, right?
Yeah. But yeah, liqueurs are great too. I used to use those to make wheat beer. I've done with triple sec. You got to do those story problems. If you know what the proof is and you take your hydrometer and you measure the specific gravity of a liqueur, those two things plus the alcohol content, you can figure out what the what percentage of sugar it is, more or less, like what bricks it is. And so once you know what Brix it is, you have an idea of how much sugar is in there that you can use to calculate your how much, like if you're priming a keg, you can prime it using about a bottle of triple sec, as I recall. Maybe a little more, little extra sugar besides one bottle of triple sec will do about
the liqueur is presumably going to ferment too when you put it in, right?
It's sugar and it's going to ferment.
Exactly, absolutely. Yeah.
It's going to gain a percent or two from the liqueur that you add. I always used to love to do this with Christmas beers and pumpkin beers. Not that I brewed a lot of those, but the Christmas beers, you know, those can be kind of a train wreck. You know, and I found that there's a very small quantitative difference between not enough and way too much. And there's sort of a real sweet spot for where that herbal character is. And in fact, I used to mix up a herb mix. And then as the beer, I would test it when the beer got close to completion, and I would taste it the day before I packaged. And if I thought the mixture either had too much cinnamon or not enough, or thought I could be improved by changing things out a little bit, I would add a little more of that ingredient to that tincture and then filter that out the next day and go ahead and add it to the packaging. So, you know, and you can again do like 100 mils with a pipetter and then just scale that up. It's super simple to do. It gives you a ton of flexibility. When we started Five Rabbit, we actually made dummy beers that way, and we took them out to distributors and people that we were talking to about contract brewing and said, look, this is just not really a brewed beer, but this is what we're going for. And, you know, we had beers with passion fruits and chilies, and there's almost no kind of flavor ingredient that you can think of that you couldn't do in that sort of prototyping way. So it's really powerful, fun, simple, saves a lot of time, which, you know, in the business means money, but it gives you a lot of flexibility.
Well, Randy, I know there's a couple other topics you wanted to cover. We didn't get through it all. Maybe we can do it for another episode, but I wanted to get your closing thoughts on working with specialty ingredients in your beer.
Yeah, I'd say just go for it. Try and get inspiration wherever you see it. You know, think about cuisine. There's a couple of great books, The Flavor Bible, The Flavor Matrix, give you great ideas for things that go together well in a couple of different ways. So that's real important. Just get out there and have fun. And I will just give a plug for a book that's coming up. We haven't finalized the title, but it's a tasting book, but it is not a beer book. It's going to really be a science journalism book about the science of tasting as kind of a science of chemical senses like smelling and taste as told through what you need to do to learn to be a taster. So that should be out not next year, but the year after. So it's kind of a long-term project, but it's going to be good.
Nice, Randy. Well, I appreciate it. And thank you again for coming on the show. Appreciate you being here.
Yeah, my pleasure, Brad. It's always great to chat.
A big thank you to Randy Mosher for joining me this week. Thanks also to Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. They're currently offering 20% off their all-access subscription pass with access to videos, brewing courses, exclusive articles, and the amazing Craft Beer and Brewing Magazine. Go to beerandbrewing.com/beersmith to get your all-access pass today. Again, that's beerandbrewing.com/beersmith. And also the BrewEasy, brew big in small spaces with the best all-grain, ultra-compact system available. The BrewEasy's revolutionary setup combines batch sparge efficiency, brew-in-a-bag simplicity, and the wort clarification of a rim system. It's easy to set up, easy to operate, and easy on the eyes. Electric and propane models are available. It's also the system that I personally brew on. Visit BlickmanEngineering.com for more information. Again, that's BlickmanEngineering.com. And finally, I converted the BeersmithRecipes.com website to support mobile devices and also added the majority of the Beersmith brewing and unit conversion tools to the site. Subscribers to Beersmith 3 can access over 17 brewing tools online from any device, and anyone with an account can access tens of thousands of recipes stored on BeersmithRecipes.com. Visit BeersmithRecipes.com from your phone or computer to learn more. Thank you for listening. I hope you have a great brewing week.